Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name's Patrick Gray, and yeah, you might have noticed North Korea's been in the news over the last couple of days. Well, we're going to stick with the theme. We've got a great feature interview this week with Andrea Berger. She's a senior research associate at the US-based James Martin Center for Non-Proliferation Studies, and she's also the co-host of the Arms Control Wonk podcast. And this week she speaks with Risky Business contributor Hillary Louise about a report the center did into North Korea's IT industry. Yes, I am as surprised as you are that North Korea has an IT industry, and you'll be quite surprised, I'm sure, as I was, by its scope and reach. That is this week's feature interview. This week's sponsor interview is with Signal Sciences co-founder and CEO, Andrew Peterson. Andrew was at a Gartner event in DC last week, and I grabbed some time with him to talk about what's new in DevSecOps, how people are applying various DevSecOps tools, and what the general awareness of good DevSecOps practices is out there. It's a really interesting chat, actually, because, you know, Andrew's prior career was in development, not security. He and Zane Lackey worked together at Etsy, and Signal Sciences was very much inspired by the work that they both did there. So yeah, Andrew says analysts are starting to understand that web application security isn't something you drop onto a network in an appliance, and that things are actually changing. That is coming up later. But before all of that, it is time, of course, for a check of the week's security news with our good friend, Mark Piper. And Pipes, we've seen the US government drop some sanctions onto a handful of Russian security firms and a few individuals as well.
Yeah, so the US government came out, the Treasury Department came in and imposed some sanctions on about five companies, I think, across three individuals, including ERP Scan, which is widely used for sort of SAP security analysis, and just said, because of your relationship with the Russian government, we are now dropping you onto the sanctions list, and have not said pretty much anything further than that at this stage, and they refused to comment for articles.
It's funny, I actually know one of the people who's affected by this, which is the ERP Scan founder, Alexander Polyakov. And he's just, we met up once at a conference in South Africa, and he was coming to Australia as part of AusCert as well, and I was going to be there, and he had some spare time in Australia. I said, hey, why don't you know, after AusCert, come down to my town, we can have some beers. And we did, you know, we hung out, and he's got the best supervillain moustache you've ever met, but he doesn't strike me as the FSB type, let me just put it that way. So I spent a little bit of time this morning trying to unpick this, and it looks like this firm, Digital Security, is the real target here. Apparently, they've been providing material and technological support to the FSB, like I'd imagine many defense contractors in, you know, the United States or Australia do to our signals intelligence agencies and other intelligence agencies. But yeah, they look like the real target here. And what's interesting is their CEO is also the CEO of ERP Scan and Embedi, right? Two of the other companies named in this. So it looks like because of that overlap with the CEO, who's not actually named as one of the individuals in this, that ERP Scan, Embedi, and, you know, a couple others got caught up in this as well.
Yeah, and I think Digital Security was listed as, you know, doing a large amount of research via their research team as well when I checked this out. So it doesn't surprise me, but yeah, it seems to have just dropped out of thin air, and the no comment thing was interesting as well.
I do wonder if Alex might be able to sort of spin the tech out into a separate company, or what will happen if they ditch their CEO. Apparently, there, you know, you can make appeals, you know, against these types of sanctions. So we'll just sort of see. But it does kind of look like that shared CEO is what's stitched people up. Staying with, you know, all things sanctions, it looks like, you know, this whole ZTE thing is still a live issue in the US. There's a bunch of Republican senators trying to undo Trump's deal to, you know, resurrect ZTE.
Yeah, this is the story that just keeps on going. So where we're at the moment is a number of senators have come up and said, yep, we want to shut down the renegotiation that's occurred with ZTE. Along with that, they have sort of one of the articles asserted that there seems to be a Chinese government loan theme park being built in Indonesia that may have some Trump-banded golf courses and hotels, and that critics have sort of pointed as that as one of the reasons why the ZTE deal was allowed to be retabled to begin with.
That's interesting. Yeah, so the Chinese government has loaned $500 million to this development, which Trump is very much involved with. I've been following that one because that particular area, that town in Indonesia, is where I lived when I was a kid. So I've just sort of been tracking that one, and that looks shady as hell.
Yeah, I mean, the whole thing, especially that's been going on in the background, feels shady. And now these senators are coming out and saying, you know, we think it is shady and we just want to make it go away.
Yeah. Well, I guess it's going to be a live story for some time yet. Marcus Hutchins, a.k.a. Malware Tech, is finding himself in even more trouble in the United States. He's been whacked with a superseding indictment. And, yeah, I don't think he's going to be leaving the United States anytime soon.
Yeah, it's an interesting development. Effectively, as mentioned, the superseding indictment got dropped, and it asserts that not only was he responsible for the development of another hacking tool on top of Kronos, which is called UPASKit, but that he also lied to the authorities when they arrested him and were questioning him. So at the moment, it sits where, you know, his lawyers are saying, no, this is all lies. It's still to go to court, obviously, and still to see a lot of evidence come out. But it seems to be one of those developments that's just going to extend the life of this court case even further.
Yeah, UPASKit is some sort of form grabber component. And I think there's a further allegation that he had been blogging and critiquing other malware. And I think the FBI's assertion there is that he was doing that to like boost sales of his own malware. So there's a bit of hand wringing going on with people saying, oh, he's facing criminal sanctions for blogging about something. But I think, you know, maybe the FBI's arguing that intent matters here.
Yeah, that's exactly it. He wrote a blog post or a series of blog posts around FaceBot, sort of in late 2014. And that's exactly the accusation, is that, well, this was to discredit the competition to boost sales of his own product, whereas, you know, the other side's been pointed out, well, that would actually help the authors of FaceBot to increase their capability and make it better themselves. So it's a tough one on where all this sits.
Yeah.
There was one really interesting comment.
But he'd also, like, I should point out that in that blog post, he was pointing out, like, actual bugs and showing exploitation of, like, their control panel and stuff. So it wasn't just, like, a teardown. It was like, here's how you own their C2, right?
Yeah, exactly. And there was one interesting comment in here, which came from Marcus Christian, who's a lawyer based around cyber security law in the US, where he pointed out it's usually a bad sign when charging additional crimes, particularly ones that have to do with lack of honesty, so there could be someone else who's cooperating. So effectively what they're saying is that someone may be talking in the background.
Yeah, yeah. So, not a great time for Marcus Hutchins. VPN filter, this is the botnet apparently taking over a whole bunch of, routers and whatnot that's been linked to Russian authorities. Got a new write-up here from Cisco Talos that says that it's actually a lot worse than previously reported, which is interesting.
Yeah, so they've obviously been pulling the thread that is VPN filter. They found it that affects a number more vendors and router models than originally thought. And they also have some pretty interesting developments where they've managed to pull some third stage modules that have been seen in the wild off it. And these third stage modules allow you to do stuff like inject into clear text traffic as it traverses the router, and also has a wiper functionality. So what's really interesting here is ALSA, which is their traffic injection capability. It can basically monitor for port 80 traffic against various websites, and then it can inject JavaScript into the response pages going back to the endpoint on the local network to run exploitation against endpoint users.
So it's still very much a live botnet?
Very much alive, and it seems to be quite actively being developed and staged, yeah.
Yeah, great. That'll be fun later. Kaspersky, meanwhile, is continuing its charm offensive, touting its new, you know, transparency initiative and its big move to Switzerland. I was invited just the other day to Sydney to attend a press briefing on this. I mean, Kaspersky really is pushing this pretty hard, but the pushback is quite notable.
Yeah, so their main goal at the moment is to launch this transparency center in Switzerland, which is, you know, the perfect country to do it, where they can say we can open things up and we can talk about our technology and we can show that we're not malicious. And the answer was, it's too little too late. We don't trust you, from the US authorities. So it's an interesting move, and they're obviously working very hard, but there seems to be a very concrete mindset inside the United States government, at least at the moment, and apparently the UK government as well, as to what this means.
Well, and the European Union, the European Parliament actually has proposed banning Kaspersky products, which they've referred to as confirmed as malicious. And I think, you know, I wonder how well they're going to do. I mean, will it be a death spiral? I'm frankly a little bit surprised it hasn't been so far, but it looks like they're kind of bleeding out slowly. But who knows? Maybe this transparency initiative will be enough to, you know, preserve enough customers that they'll continue as a viable company, and perhaps when relations with Russia eventually improve, maybe they will. Maybe they'll bounce back. Now, I've got a couple of stories here that are very, very interesting with regard to Chinese activity. Apparently, you know, Chinese hackers. CyberScoop headline says Chinese hackers stole sensitive U.S. Navy submarine plans from a contractor. To which I say that seems like a pretty straight up, honest, you know, SIGINT op, right? Like, you can't judge them for this.
Yeah, I mean, they were basically running around having a look for submarine designs. They ended up going through the contractors, which as we've seen before out of the Chinese teams, where target the contractors who are working on various components. In this case, they hit a company called Sea Dragon, which had a number of contracts with other companies that are sort of related to General Dynamics and various other defense industry companies around technology around that, and they just went wholesale, took, I think it was half a terabyte of data. Interesting, FireEye did actually put out early March, I think it was, notification saying, hey, we're seeing a lot of lot of activity around contractors to do with marine work for defense. So it seems to just be an ongoing campaign that's sort of now become public.
Now, McClatchy's has a terrific piece here talking about how, you know, Chinese activity, and this is something that we followed, you know, all through the time that this happened, Chinese activity did drop off after that agreement was signed in 2015 between Barack Obama and Xi Jinping. You know, things did drop off. Groups, I know some people who are watching some of these groups and they just sort of vanished. They are coming back big time. And the assertion here seems to be that that is because of renewed trade tensions between the United States and China. So it looks like as that relationship deteriorates, these APT crews are coming back and they're targeting things like biomedicine, robotics, cloud computing and artificial intelligence. You know, they're going wild. And it's all part of this Made in China 2025 initiative.
Yeah, I mean, as always, when we look at Chinese actors, they follow patterns and they generally follow the 5 to 10 year plans that have been set down by the central government there. They did back off after the agreement in 2015, and that was well noted and well seen. I think the main increase we saw was actually targeting of, you know, MSS providers, you know, managed service providers in Japan and the likes. We saw a massive sort of increase in that. One of the interesting assertions in the article that I personally found interesting, they also assert that there's been a massive restructure internally within the Chinese military around how they manage cyber operations, and rather than having these, you know, multiple different little groups that they have running operations, they've sort of merged them into one big group called the Strategic Support Force, which is not only a badass name, but also sounds like it's, you know, what they do on the tin, which is to go find intellectual property and intelligence to support the nation.
Yeah, I mean, I do find it, I thought it was incredible that agreement actually worked. And it is a shame to see it unraveling because, you know, it's how quickly we forget what those activity levels were before that agreement was signed. Then it wasn't just something affecting government. It was something affecting all types of business. So it just feels like that relationship between the United States and China getting a little bit stressed is going to cause problems for all sorts of CISOs.
Yeah, exactly. And it's also interesting to note that, you know, like previously, they do follow patterns. As you mentioned earlier, there are specific verticals of industry and there are specific targets that they have. So I'm pretty sure we're about to see a massive increase in blog posts out of the monitoring players to say, hey, we're seeing this sort of activity across these verticals that align to the ones that have been sort of set down by the Chinese government.
Yeah, well, I'm guessing CrowdStrike's all over it because that seems to be where they're happiest playing. So, yeah, we look forward to their long research blogs. Iceberg, disclosure, they're a risky business sponsor. They spotted a zero-day in Flash being used against a diplomatic target in Qatar, which is like, you know, it's nice that Flash gets to have one last drive around the block before it's retired.
Yeah, I mean, I have to admit, when I saw their blog post the other day, I had to check the year for the publication to make sure that we're talking 2018 here. But sure enough, Iceberg released a post where they said that we saw Flash being used, coming out of effectively embedded out of office documents to target individuals within the Middle East. They appeared to be politically motivated, they say. There's a fairly good write-up out there from both Iceberg and also Chihu, which, yeah, it's interesting how many people spotted it within immediate time of its use as well. Like, we're obviously very good now picking up and reverse engineering flash bugs.
Yeah, so maybe don't use them anymore, right? Because you're going to get caught. Now, look, you know, this is a thing we've spoken about on the show a few times, this idea that Cyber Command under Trump will be encouraged to become more aggressive. And it looks like there's some steps in that direction at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, there's been a sort of review of some of the law within the US at the moment, notably the National Defense Authorization Act. Huge focus on cyber on that, where effectively they say, hey, look, the gloves need to come off. We don't need to seek, you know, high approval every time we want to go hacking back or go targeting individuals in cyberspace or organizations or nation states in cyberspace. So can we just have a little bit of leeway there, please and thank you? Mm. And the support seems to be there for the bill as well.
Well, that's it. I mean, I don't even know that this is an executive initiative. There's, you know, senators quoted in this. So it looks like it's you know, not just the executive branch pushing for it, but it just really feels like the stars are in alignment for a much more aggressive Cyber Command. And, you know, look further to that, there's this next story here also from CyberScoop where Senator Mark Warner is proposing that the United States get serious about responding to election interference instead of just observing it. Then again, I mean, this guy's a Democrat and it does, you know, you can just feel there's shades of partisan bullshit wrapped up in this one.
Yeah, but I think it's still in line with the idea that I suspect is being echoed quite loudly inside the halls in Washington at the moment is, well, Russia can come and hack us, China can come and hack us, how come we can't respond just as aggressively? Or how come we can't call that a red line and send our cyber munitions over the you know, cyber borders into their countries?
The internet weapons.
Internet weapon.
Yeah, exactly. And it just seems to be that's the page everyone's sort of reading at the moment. That's where everyone wants to go. But yeah, it'll be interesting to see what happens if they actually leverage that fully, if they get the authorization.
Yeah. Staying with US law now, and Congress is looking at introducing a bill that would prevent the states from like banning products for sale because they have strong encryption, which is just, I don't really get this because most of the important legislation here is going to be federal stuff, right? And I can't see Minnesota banning iPhones.
Yeah, so when I first read this, I had the exact same response. And then I remembered that, you know, within the states, obviously, they all have different sort of state laws and what the authorities can do. And so, for example, we've seen a huge uptick recently in capabilities to local police forces, especially using the likes of stingrays and other sort of interception technology. And it's only a matter of time before they start telling their lawmakers locally, like, hey, we have to be able to access systems if they're hosted in our jurisdiction. Mm. So whether or not they would ever be successful with such a law, I doubt it.
Well, I just think banning the sale of iPhones is a great way to lose an election, you know? Like, yeah, I just exactly. can't see a governor signing that piece of paper unless they want to commit, you know, electoral seppuku.
Absolutely. But what this article tells me, what this federal level tells me is they're obviously hearing whispers of it. They've obviously been asked about it and they're getting ahead of it now.
Yeah. Right?
They're stopping that rhetoric and that discussion straight away.
Yeah, well, we'll see. We'll see if that one actually gets up. Meanwhile, the FBI has taken down 74 people all across the world. You know, and they've been doing these email scams involving dodgy bank transfers. It is remarkable to me, like, how many people are getting smashed with this. Alex Tilley, who is ex-Australian Federal Police and now works for SecureWorks, did a really good talk at AusCert the other week about this particular type of crime. I mean, what they'll do is they'll take over an 0365, you know, account of a real estate agent, and they can see in the calendar like settlement instructions and whatnot and when various transfers are supposed to occur, and then they can man in the middle of the mail and just rack off with the money. I mean, the people who lose here, have no recourse because the banks can just say, well, we just executed the transfer instructions you gave us. The real estate agents are saying, well, it's not our problem. Do you know what I mean? So this is a really serious crime type, and it's great to see law enforcement actually get somewhere and, you know, lock a few people up for it.
Yeah, I mean, this has become bread and butter work for a lot of fraudsters out there, right?
Yeah.
As doing these interceptions. I mean, we've even seen it at, you know, procurement layers a lot of the time as well, where they're saying, hey, we want to procure 3,000 servers and please pay the invoice to this random bank account. So it's definitely become bread and butter, which means, I guess, their investigation process and their ability to understand that crime and understand how it works has become pretty bread and butter as well. And I think this is the first sort of show result from that.
Well, the Treasury Department's Financial Crimes Enforcement Network says it recovered $350 million stolen from US citizens since 2014, which makes you wonder how much wasn't recovered, you know, to be exactly. to be frank, right? And one thing that really stuck out to me is, you know, I wonder, I just think Microsoft should really be strongly encouraging people to turn on 2FA for 0365 by default, because there's real harm being done with this, and 2FA would make a lot of this go away. It really would. So I think maybe there's something for Microsoft to think about there. Some cool research here from Okta. They actually gave me a heads up on this under embargo. It's about bypassing third-party macOS signature checks. And there's a good write-up from Dan Gooden at Ars.
Yeah, excellent work from Josh Pitts over at Okta. Effectively, he took a look at code signing on macOS binaries, to, you know, the mechanism that makes sure that the binary you're running is actually signed by the developer, and found with certain conditions in the way that they do the Mac OS loader, you can actually have, you know, malicious code sort of executed as if it was a signed binary. And this is related to the bundling format effectively you can have with Mac OS binaries. So Apple introduced a file format that you can have executables that support multiple platforms or can have, you know, effectively different revisions of the binary for different target environments in one binary. And if you manipulate the binary in a sense that it's partly legitimate signed and it's partly illegitimately signed, and there's sort of a couple of other factors at play, then the code sign checking will basically say, no, it's all good, and this is a signed binary, as if it came from Apple or, you know, some other sort of trusted organization.
This isn't a problem Apple can fix, is it? It's more about the packager.
It's largely to do with the packager and the way that developers use the APIs to package and verify. I think from memory, there are some changes coming to the way that Apple signs binaries in the new OS 10 that's got announced at WWDC in the last week or so. But it's also really just about awareness on what these limitations are and how to spot them. And along with the research, Josh has dropped some really good proof of concepts and some tools to sort of help work through that process. There's a great write-up on the Okta security blog that's well worth a read on it if you want the technical details.
Yeah, we'll link through to that in this week's show notes. Brazil has suspended use of all paper ballots, and they do have an election coming up in October. And let me just tell you, things are a little bit tense over there at the moment.
Yeah, this is when I read this, I was wondering if I was reading it correctly, but effectively, yes, they've said, look, fraud occurs on paper ballots. We trust electronic voting. We're now doing electronic voting. Deal with it. And there obviously seems to be a lot of raised eyebrows and question marks and more questions than answers that's come out of this. But that's exactly what they're doing, and they're pushing through with it.
Yeah, and look, the political environment over there is just super tense at the moment. The current president, who came to power by impeaching the other one, the previous president, has an approval rating of something like 5%. They've got an absolutely insane fascist candidate. The guy who's leading the polling is two presidents ago, and he's in prison. And, you know, basically public trust in government officials in Brazil is near zero. There's even people who want the military to take over. I don't think that'll happen. But, you know, you see a story like this, like in the midst of all of that, and, you know, when there's a trust crisis, and you just think, gee, I hope you know what you're doing. But, yeah, all eyes on Brazil in October. Let's put it that way. Motherboard has a piece up saying some signal disappearing messages are not disappearing, but it seems like this is pretty limited in impact.
Yeah, so it effectively looks like somewhere around May 22nd, I believe it was, certain messages that should have disappeared after a set period of time on that day have not disappeared from the devices. Signal has said that, you know, it was a glitch in the system, and that the messages are hanging around on the end user client, they can be manually deleted and that it hasn't been an issue going forward. But it's a classic example of where, you know, software is never perfect. And as we work through trying to figure out new technologies and get them to work, glitches are going to happen.
Yeah, I don't think it doesn't strike me as a particularly big deal. Also, some documents, Motherboard turned up some DHS documents that are talking about airliner security, which actually look kind of interesting. It looks like the US government is definitely taking this this risk seriously. And it ties into some news we reported on, I think it was last year, about some documents that were doing the rounds talking about like RF-based attacks against aircraft that were very, very hush-hush. But it looks like DHS is, yeah, taking it seriously.
Yeah, I mean, it effectively looks to me from what was released under the Official Information Act, I believe, was the Pacific Northwest National Laboratory effectively set about trying to document out what are the attack vectors on aircraft when it comes to, you know, technology as far as passenger Wi-Fi, back of the seat, entertainment systems, satellite communications for, you know, aircraft operation, and then have set about a piece of work to sort of start going through, seeing what, you know, where do we sit with these. The results aren't entirely clear. There's some, like, you know, interesting wordings that comes out of various documents, which basically assert that, well, there's a lot of work to be done here. But it's, you know, it seems to be a pretty decent project to be undertaking, and it'll be really interesting to see if they ever do come out publicly with the full results set and said, here's what we discovered.
Mm. Now, Catalin Kimpanu, and I'm not sure if that's the correct pronunciation, he is a journalist at Bleeping Computer and has a habit of turning up stories that just don't get covered elsewhere, and this one is fantastic. Apparently a bank in Chile had a real bad time when they got hit by wiper malware, but that was just being used as a distraction while attackers went after their Swift terminals. This is a great story.
Oh, this is just the most brilliant quote-unquote cyber diversion, I guess. Like,
they're not messing around, eh? It's like they're like, yeah, setting the building on fire as a diversion, right?
Yeah, so effectively they hit the bank with a fake ransomware and a Kildisk variant wiper that, you know, sort of wipes the MBR and the file system, so when you go to reboot the machine, you can't reboot it. And while they're sitting there running through, sort of triaging this incident going on at the bank, the attackers were in there trying to steal money via the Swift network. Now, they assert they weren't successful, and they also assert that the same group was behind a failed attempt against a Mexican bank not too long ago as well. But it's a novel way to keep the responders busy while you're off doing your nefarious activities. And one of the things that I find interesting is whether or not they failed at the Swift hack, because maybe they wiped the wrong box that had the tool they needed. I'm not sure.
You never know, right? But interestingly enough, I think it was originally written up as this being a failed attack, but there's a note on the end of the article saying that a day after the article was published, the Chilean bank admitted that the attackers got away with $10 million, which is, you know, not bad for a day's work.
Well, I missed that completely, and that's pretty decent for a day's work.
It is. I don't get paid that much. I'm sure you don't either. Ars Technica is reporting that Apple has banned cryptocurrency mining on iOS devices. So, you know, I guess you're going to have to tolerate bullshit pop-up ads for a while longer, because you can't just drain your CPU to mine anymore.
I honestly didn't know anyone was mining on there. Yeah, iOS devices.
Well, not willingly.
Yeah. It seems that, yep. They've said, no, let's not allow that in our guidelines. So what I love is, you know, amongst all of the terms and conditions buried in the guidelines, somewhere someone was reading every single line to find that one thing that had changed. So good spotting to them.
Good spotting to them indeed. Now, you know these cryptocurrency giveaway scammers, right? The ones who pop up in Twitter threads saying, hey, you know, send us a Bitcoin and we'll send you 10 back because we're really generous. Apparently those scams targeting like Ether, they've tricked people out of $4.3 million, which might explain why it's so prevalent.
Yeah, making bank, right? Yeah, if anyone's been on Twitter and looked at any high-profile accounts in the last, I'd say, 2 or 3 months, we've seen, you know, the immediate reply to any tweet that comes from someone popular, and, you know, Musk has obviously been one of the big ones targeted here, is, you know, you send us some, we'll send you double back type deal. And obviously it works. So seems to be making bank for them.
Yeah, and great stat here from research coming out of Palo Alto Networks, which is 5% of all Monero currently in circulation was mined using malware.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of those things that I've struggled with for the longest time, is to understand, is anyone actually making money on Monero? Is it worth anything? Like, I just don't know. But apparently, yeah, 5% of the entire pool has come from malware.
Yeah, which is surprising considering those studies showing the amount of compute that was required on normal processors to actually, you know,
yeah,
make some. So that just tells me there's a lot of owned devices out there. That's what that says. Oh, meanwhile, this Trick spam botnet apparently leaked 43 million email addresses. And, you know, again, this is one of Catalan's stories from Bleeping Computer. I think this is massively newsworthy. Just because it's not a traditional data breach doesn't mean it's not a data breach. 43 million email addresses is 43 million email addresses.
Yeah, I absolutely love this write-up because one of the things I love reading about as researchers, you know, having those WTF moments. And this Vertec researcher was obviously having a poke at some campaign that had come through for the Trick Trojan or something like that. And next minute had, you know, 43 million email addresses disclosed in a directory index. So it's nice work. And the write-up from the team over there at Vertec was good to note. And yeah, interesting times.
Well, Pipes, thank you very much for joining us to do this week's news, for being stunt metal. It's always great to have you on the show, mate. That was a lot of fun. And we'll chat to you again soon.
Always a pleasure, Bert. Thanks.
That was Insomnia Security's Mark Piper there with a look at the week's news headlines. He was filling in, of course, for Adam Boileau. I want to say a quick thank you, too, to Mara Tam, who helped me make sense of some of these sanctions against those Russian companies this morning. Thank you, Mara. And yeah, you know, sanctioning ERP scans seems like a bit of an own goal, considering how useful that software is. But yeah, we'll just have to wait and see how that all shakes out. Okay, it is time for this week's feature piece now, prepared by a new Risky Business contributor, Hilary Louise. Hilary is an award-winning broadcast journalist who now works in AppSec, which, you know, what a find from my perspective, right? And she filed this report. So a recent report published by the US-based James Martin Center for Non-Proliferation Studies shone a light on the web of IT-related companies and technologies originating in North Korea and their global ties. The report is called Shadow Sector, and its co-author, Andrea Berger, a senior research associate at the James Martin Center, spoke to Hilary Louise all about it. Berger says while everyone's been focused on North Korean APT crews and, you know, criminal activity, its IT sector has been chugging along quite nicely. Thank you very much. Here's Andrea Berger.
That public discussion, at least over North Korean cyber activities, is really only a few years old. People really got woken up, I think, by the Sony Pictures attack in 2014. And while, you know, South Korea and others had been attentive to this before because they were previously targets, Sony brought this to the international stage as a big issue and really caused people to start paying attention to what North Korea might be doing in cyberspace. But largely, at least from my observation, I think the discussion around North Korean cyber activities has focused mostly on how they use hacking, malware, viruses, etc., in order to coerce, disrupt, or try to generate revenue in the case of North Korea's purported hacking of SWIFT and rerouting of funds out of Bangladesh's bank accounts. So that's really where our focus has centered in terms of discussion of risk and threats. And we haven't really looked a lot at what North Korea's commercial presence overseas in the IT sector might be used for in terms of strategic application for some of those same purposes. Now, it's hard to get a handle on whether they might try to use products that they have sold or any kind of services that they've assisted companies in developing in the IT space later for some more malicious end. But that is a risk. I think North Korea has traditionally exploited many of its commercial activities for its higher strategic objectives, and that might be the case here as well.
Yeah. So do you see, or does your research point to a connection between these IT companies, that IT sector, and maybe some larger threat models that we might be talking about more mainstream?
We haven't been able to look at any of the software that they've actually sold overseas. And so that's definitely a gap in our own research, and we fully acknowledge that. Really, what we've been able to identify is the type of networks that they're operating, get a sense of some of the tactics they use in order to remain concealed as North Koreans in the commercial marketplace, and then look at the types of specific product areas or service areas that they're active in. So one of the ones that's really been interesting to us is North Korean activity and sales of of software and services and purportedly algorithms in biometric identification. So fingerprint scanning or facial recognition software in particular are two big ones that we see coming up over and over again when we look at North Korean IT companies. And they've managed to sneak those in, I think, to global supply chains without us really paying much attention. So once we started looking, we found a number of manufacturers of, let's say, fingerprint scanners who purport to use North Korean algorithms, and found some of the North Korean companies that claim to sell these algorithms. So that's kind of interesting. We may be using products that have some North Korean tech in the background without us even realizing. And those types of products or services could have security applications as fingerprint scanners do, or as facial recognition software does.
Can you touch on what sort of work went into the research that you did, kind of talking about the process behind it?
In terms of doing investigations, we use a pretty wide and fairly creative set of sources. And, you know, over time, once you start looking at enough North Korean networks, you get a good sense of the signatures or red flags, so to speak, of a North Korean front company trying to conceal itself as being some other Asian company that's legitimate, or in certain cases, European or African or what have you. So we used a lot of that knowledge for this specific research as well. So we were looking at connections to existing networks that we've seen. So in particular, we were looking in one case at companies that were affiliated with a front company that North Korean intelligence agencies had claimed they'd set up in Malaysia. They were using that to market military goods and services overseas. The UN called them out on it in 2017. But in the discussion over the military sales that that network was doing, there was very little attention paid to the IT companies that were connected to that group as well. And so we started to unpack those using a range of methods, you know, connecting the directors or shareholders on the companies, looking at some of the shared web infrastructure that the website for the military sales had with other websites, and then linking potential front companies that way. And then once you got there, we used a whole other range of investigative techniques, from reverse image searching to checking, you know, common claims or language on websites, to again, you know, looking at web infrastructure and corporate registry documents in order to build a picture out further.
So that part is particularly fascinating to me. I think when we talk about maybe malware or other threat activity, you know, we look at these indicators of compromise. And to me, it feels almost like you're applying that methodology to the research that you're doing. And did you see that there were commonalities across the companies that you investigated? I made a note for Glocom and Future Tech Group.
That's right.
Sharing some infrastructures. Could you touch on that?
Yeah. So one, you know, there were a few bits of common infrastructure there, but the one we highlighted in particular was that Future Tech Group, this what we think could be a North Korean front company, and I'll come to why we think that might be. Future Tech Group, its expired SSL certificate was self-signed by Glocom, and that was really an interesting piece of information there that resulted in us going to take a further look at Future Tech Group. And when we did, we found, you know, initially some things that might not cause alarm. A IT company selling mushroom growing technology, which is something fairly uniquely North Korean. The North Koreans love their mushroom farms and the tech around mushroom growing. So that was one. The Korean machine translation was another one on the site, but really the one I think that was the biggest red flag for us was that their marketing video used as the background music a version of the Rocky theme tune that the North Korean girl band, the Moranbong band, had performed for Kim Jong-un back in 2012. And it's a really famous song in the world of North Korea. So that, you know, kind of led us to conclude that there was a good chance here that that was a North Korean front company.
That's fascinating. Your report highlights several areas of specialization. You touched on a couple of these: military-grade hardware and software, technologies like facial recognition. I think your report also touched on web-based developers that may have some explicit or implicit ties to these things. Inside of that, is there a sector in particular that you believe to be more dangerous than the others or worthy of a deeper look?
It's hard to say, because it's hard to say what North Korea might want to do with the commercial relationships that it's building here. So let's say it is providing some form of algorithm for fingerprint scanning, or let's say it is creating new facial recognition software for law enforcement applications for a foreign law enforcement agency, which was one of the things we suspect as a result of our investigations. Given that some of these companies are indirectly but fairly clearly linked to North Korea's intelligence agencies, are they using that as a form of intelligence on foreign targets? So are they somehow collecting that information? This is, as a non-IT specialist, something that's really difficult for me to understand, but strikes me as a potential risk given the actors involved and the type of potential customers and the type of service being provided.
There's an emphasis in the report on sanctions. And my read on it was these sanctions are sort of missing the point, so to speak, when it comes to that sector. Korea Computer Center was mentioned as a specific target of U.S. sanctions. Do you see that sort of targeting continuing? Do you think it will help? Do you see challenges to making this happen?
If you look at one of the roles that sanctions do play, it is to raise awareness among parts of the private sector about where their risk might lie and where North Korean activity is really prevalent. So they can be a useful signaling device and information sharing device, if you will, that reaches a pretty large public audience and therefore has an important role in that that awareness raising effort that I think here is lacking. It's less likely to actually create a meaningful disruptive effect. North Korea is really good at hiding its activities, especially when you're dealing with organizations linked to an intelligence agency. You know, they're going to be pretty sophisticated, and it will be hard for many in the legitimate private sector to pick up on the fact that they might be dealing with a North Korean freelancer who's claiming to be Vietnamese or something. But nevertheless, sanctions here have been really narrow. In fact, they're not treated at the UN level yet in terms of covering IT. The United States does make mention of it in one of their new executive orders, but really only the Korea Computer Center, as you noted, has been sanctioned. And so in terms of awareness raising effect, it hasn't, I don't think, had that yet. We haven't managed to communicate to particular sectors who might be at risk, those operating in biometric identification, for example, that North Korea is selling stuff into global supply chains and you should do your due diligence on where you're buying these things from. So that is, I think, potentially an area where there's productive sanctions-related activity that could continue. I don't want to suggest that this is necessarily, you know, an open door where we should be sanctioning all North Korean activity in the IT space. Indeed, South Korea is talking right now about using that as a potential avenue for future cooperation. So two directions here, but some selective designations on North Korean entities might go pretty far in terms of awareness activity. And I wouldn't be surprised if the U.S. Treasury does go down that road in the not too distant future. Their September executive order from President Trump, I think, signaled already that this is on their radar.
I think you kind of touched on this earlier and again in that last question. Your report noted a specific but unnamed company in a U.S. allied country with some sort of unwitting tie to what may be believed to be a front company, North Korean front company. Do you think that this could be more widespread in talking about due diligence or maybe just that lack of awareness?
Absolutely. And one of the reasons I think there's likely to be quite a number of inadvertent customers of these North Korean products and services is because North Korea seems to be using, in terms of efforts to conceal the fact that the providers of these things are North Korean, seems to be using freelancer platforms. So it combines aliases and fake profile pictures and fake freelancer profiles on these pages and uses those then seemingly to market and generate leads for IT related business. So if that's the case, then, you know, you might see a freelancer page for, let's say, I don't know, a North Korean purporting to be a Chinese individual who says that he's got a group of developers sitting behind him and is available to do work in these specialist areas for a reasonable rate. Leads might then be generated through those freelancer platforms, and North Korea could have a fairly steady stream of business ticking through just by that very simple approach to hiding the true nature of the developers doing the work.
In your work across the sector, what's something that surprised you?
It surprised me that, one, North Korea has been winning international prizes for this sort of stuff. We actually came across several, but in the 90s, North Korea seems to have done really well in getting prizes at the International Inventions Exhibition in Geneva, where it's IT and related work, in particular certain types of biometric identification software, got it some gold and silver prizes. I thought that was pretty interesting. But more recently, and I can't go into the details of this one, we explain why in the report, but they've also won a pretty big prize, international prize, through a company that is not advertised as North Korean. And so the prizes were pretty interesting. Similarly to me, another interesting point was just the diversity of stuff they're offering in this area. So we talked a lot about the biometric side, but they also do everything from, you know, website creation to apps and games to virtual private networks and encryption technology to full business management suites. You name it, pretty much North Korean companies are out there offering it. And that's something that I think is really interesting, because it means that they probably have a much more active revenue stream here in particular than we probably appreciate. And we are going to have a very hard time fully appreciating it, just because of the intangible nature of this particular form of revenue generation.
Is there anything that I haven't asked or anything else you'd like to add as it relates?
This is just the tip of the iceberg. So we know that, and these were only a few cases. And so I have no doubt at all that there's going to be many more cases of North Korean IT companies potentially accessing places and customers that you wouldn't have imagined that will be coming out in the public domain in future. I'm sure there'll be more, so watch this space.
Andrea Berger, Senior Research Associate at the Middlebury Institute of International Studies at Monterey, co-author of The Shadow Sector, North Korea's Information Technology Networks, CNS Occasional Paper, out last month, and co-host of the Arms Control Wonk podcast. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Andrea Berger, interviewed by Hilary Louise there. Big thanks to both of them for that. Okay, it is time for this week's sponsor interview now with Andrew Peterson. Andrew worked at Etsy with Zane Lackey before they decided to start Signal Sciences, this week's sponsor. Signal Sciences tools are very much about enabling DevSecOps, but the hilarious part is they're making money hand over fist at the moment because they can deliver a better WAF experience than basically anyone else. So yeah, like, even though that's like a small part of the capability they deliver, that's why so many companies are actually buying their software, which is kind of a sad way to win. But it doesn't bother Andrew because, yeah, a win is a win is a win is a win. But things could be changing. Andrew was at a conference in DC, a Gartner conference in DC last week when we recorded this interview, and he says analysts and the wider market are starting to question the old ways of doing things and realize there's more to web application security than, you know, writing cleaner code and then using a WAF. He joined me last week for this interview, and here's what he had to say.
You know, what's interesting, there's kind of two themes that have come out from the folks that I've been talking to that have been here. There still really is kind of a whole section of the industry that's really stuck in this past, only focused on, you know, hardware appliance based installation of security tooling, But then they're starting to emerge this new group of certainly both analysts, but also just thinkers, I think, in the industry overall. And that's where, you know, the attendees are getting excited that like, hey, like, you know, the analyst group is actually starting to get this and starting to push forward. So Mark Horvath gave a talk earlier this week about, you know, here's how you build a program about how to build security champions within your engineering teams and engineering programs. And they have a whole, you know, he's actually like advising multiple companies about how to actually build these programs and giving them sort of the tools to be able to do that. And this is, I mean, this is the first time that I've seen this at this kind of mainstream of an event.
Well, I mean, it is crazy that we're finally now in 2018 transitioning away from a world where web application security controls means a WAF module in an F5 run by the network group, right? Like we're gonna look back on that as an approach and just laugh our asses off in the not too distant future.
Well, and you know, as I've been talking with like specifically the WAF analysts here, like I think that's one of the things that even Gartner overall is just trying to struggle with and wrestle with, which is, you know, they've historically viewed this as a network security product. And
yeah, that's nuts, right?
Well, you know, they made this decision 10 years ago, right? So this is, it was an appliance, it was a hardware piece, it was going in, that's who was managing this stuff. But, you know, this gets back to a lot of the themes that you talk about a lot, which is, look, the world of security is changing. And what we talk about a lot is the world of application development is changing. And we have to sort of change our approach to how we do a lot of things, like as it relates to those as well. So
I guess it does make sense, right? Like we did get here for a reason. We had, you know, the network people, and that's sort of where security people came from, right? In the early days. And then you had your developers, never the twain shall meet. And I think the network security people saw it as their job to save the developers from themselves. And WAF was just one tool that they could do that with, right?
I think you're spot on. And this is where, like, you know, our sort of philosophy or my philosophy on the future of where this stuff is going is that we really do need to partner with the engineering teams, because they're ultimately both making way more decisions on the technology choices that they're making, which is, you know, those are proliferating way more than just like, oh, it's just another, you know, appliance that we're going to put in somewhere. And the security people are, you know, we're sort of in this position where our responsibility is really enable them to make those decisions and, you know, sort of support them in whatever technology decisions they want to make, but still make security easy for them.
Right? It's been quite funny watching the worm turn, because it's only been quite recently, I'd say in the last sort of 3 to 4 years, where, you know, security people giving shit to developers has been standard. And like, it's only been recently that the security industry has been forced to kind of, or the security discipline has been forced to take a bit of a look in the mirror and go, well, you know, we sort of criticize developers for not understanding us, but maybe we should, you know, look at ourselves for not understanding them. So it really does feel like, and I guess it depends on the shop, it depends on the environment. It's mostly happening at very forward-looking organizations that are actually doing DevSecOps right. But it seems like they're the ones getting the wins, right?
Yeah, well, and I end up having this conversation a lot because, you know, my background wasn't in security. My background was in doing product development and working really closely with these, you know, development and operations teams, doing what, you know, historically is really the job of the developer, which is building software, right? Mm. And as I've tried to have these conversations with a lot of the security side folks that work in application security, that, you know, that we're working with now through Signal Sciences, a lot of what I try to tell them is like, look, the job of the developer, you know, it's very obvious to security people when we find these bugs in the software that they're building and we're like, hey, you know, this is so obvious. Like, why are you guys not fixing this? And I try to say like, look, like when I was the product manager and I had a bunch of these developers, I was writing them with a bunch of bugs that I knew that were stopping people from using our product in a certain way, or we needed to build new functionality. And so the developer's kind of sitting there with like, you know, there's a lot of different sort of competing priorities for.
Well, that's right. I mean, you've got some bug that might be something that a developer perceives as being very difficult to exploit, right? And you've got the security group leaning on you going, you've got to fix this yesterday. Meanwhile, you've got your product manager breathing down your neck saying, you know, this entire subclass of our users, like 20% of them can't do the thing that they signed up to our service to do. You got to fix this yesterday or there won't be a business tomorrow. So I guess that's the thing. You got developers have everyone yelling at them, right?
Yes and no. And I think like, look, in the P1 bug situation, or that, you know, the 20% of users are not being able to do what they're doing, priority becomes very clear, right? Like it's that is like very easy to prioritize and make decisions on. The stuff that I think we really struggle with as an industry is actually not the P1 bugs. It's like everything beyond that. And that's the majority of the number of bugs.
Yeah.
But but that's where it's like, it might not be a high priority or a high vulnerability bug, but that's the one that might get popped, right?
Yeah, that's like, the one that might get you owned. Yeah, you just never know.
You don't. And like this is in some ways this is a sort of a plug for our product, but like our experience when we were at Etsy talking to developers and trying to work with them, they're sort of sitting there being like, hey, I understand that you guys really view this, you know, these security flaws that you're bringing up to us as important, but you paid a pen tester to find this, or you know, you paid somebody through a bug bounty to be able to find this thing. Like, what? Like, is it really going to get found by an attacker? Are we really being attacked? And this is where, when we started to be able to show that, yeah, like this is a live attack that's happening on your code right now. Like, this is why you need to care.
Yeah.
About
so, I mean, that's why you're saying that. You know, I mean, the visibility component of what Signal Sciences does is important. I get that, and you're allowed to plug your product because you know it's a sponsor interview. So, I guess what you're saying is, you know, by giving that visibility to a developer. You know, instead of giving them alerts in developer-friendly, in developer-friendly ways, I guess that helps them set their own priorities.
What it helps them to do is that it turns this concept of a bug that is a theoretical threat into an actual threat, because it's not somebody. Again, they're like, you didn't have to pay somebody to find bugs in my code. Like, I know I have bugs in my code. What I care about is why should I prioritize working on this? And if you can say, the reason why you should prioritize working on this is because, you know, attackers are really focused on trying to attack this section of code, which is, you know, where some of these bugs lie, that is a very clear rationale or clear reason for them of why they should prioritize.
Yeah, we're getting some very interesting errors triggered by this bunch of code quite often. That's the sort of alerting language that Signal Sciences gives you, right?
It is. And there's kind of two ways then that people can use this. And I think it's sort of two ways then that developers and operations people can actually be working better with security people as a result. Is one is like, yes, there's an attack that's happening right now. We're seeing all these errors and alerts that are happening on this section of your code. So like, this is why we should care about this, right? But then there's kind of, again, the more day-to-day that I think is more common, which is, you know, security person is talking to engineering manager, trying to figure out how you actually create prioritization of, you know, their development teams working on security things overall. And you're kind of sitting there just being like, you know, will you do it, please? Like, it's really kind of more of this, like, they're asking for a favor all the time. Instead of with the information now, what we've seen, you know, our customers be able to do is to say, look, 50% of our attacks are all going to this one business unit. We have 10 business units. We're not asking the other, you know, 9 business units to really focus on security more than they have in the past. But this one business unit, like, can we try to get prioritization on, you know, doing some proactive hardening on that application for the next
quarter? Because your module, whoof, basically,
right? Like, it's like some for some reason, attackers are really focusing on your guys' business unit. So like, you know, it gives them some data to be able to then have that negotiation with the engineering manager.
I just want to stop you there, right? Because like every security startup, right, focuses their product on their vision, right? So your vision, you know, you and Zane, both ex-Etsy, right? You'd had a good approach in there. You thought you'd found a winning formula. You wanted to spin that off and take it outside Etsy and Signal Sciences was born. And that's great, right? You've created tooling that is really good for a DevSecOps shop, right? And you're having a lot of success with those sorts of shops. But I want to ask you a question now, which is your business really has taken off in the last 12 months or so. And I'd imagine that of, you know, say 100 sales, how many of them are actually the DevSecOps people versus people who are just replacing WAF? Because, I mean, it's all very well and good to create this shiny product that's so great for DevSecOps. But ultimately, like, I think the reason that you're making money hand over fist at the moment is just because most WAF products just suck. Is that actually the case?
Yeah, it is. and look, the rationale for that is, early on, I think we were in some ways really nervous to align ourselves with WAF because of how sort of bad the reputation of a lot of the products are in that space and how bad they've been for a long time, especially with development and operations groups, right?
Yeah.
Like they hear WAF, they just turn off.
Yeah.
And so we were really selling this vision on DevSecOps and why visibility really matters. Turns out not a lot of people have like budget for DevSecOps and, you know, visibility tools around security because they don't even know that they need that and they don't even know that they value that, right? Mm-hmm. So like our method now of trying to get into more groups is to be like, hey, look, you already have a WAF. Let's just show you how our WAF is better side by side. And then all of the additional components that we've sort of built in around this sort of, you know, enabling DevSecOps, enabling these groups to be working together, that's kind of a byproduct of what happens as a result of you buying this product, right? Mm. So like a lot of the things that I tell our team internally is like, look, the reason why people will buy our product is because we sell a better WAF that's, you know, cheaper to own. It's like more effective. It can work to, you know, these multi-cloud organizations that they're trying to, you know, get a product.
But there must be a side of it, right, where you've created like the tooling equivalent of like a very advanced, precise robot laser arm for manufacturing, yeah. Right? And then you've got half your customers picking it up and using it as a hammer.
Well, I mean, we do a lot of the heavy lifting for them on the back end, right? Like, so it's like, you know, a lot
so
of,
you feel like they try, they might not get the full use of it, but you are helping them actually do that. You're not just saying, here, we've replaced your WAF, you know, good luck, here's your invoice.
I mean, I don't think anybody really gets the full use out of any technology ever, yeah. Right, to begin with. But I think the thing that we do see that is actually quite satisfying is, look, again, we might just do a straight RFP against a WAF and like somebody will purchase us against, you know, anybody that's in the field, which is great. But then when we get in, we get to sort of delight them with all this additional things that they didn't even think that they were purchasing us for in the first place. And yeah. The most basic thing there is visibility of attacks. And when you talk to someone, you know, when we're talking about that, I mean, it's kind of like DevOps, like everybody kind of tosses it around as a term. You want visibility. You want telemetry. Like the rubber meets the road when people actually see it in production on their production systems. And they're like, oh, this is what you meant by that.
Yeah.
You know, like, and that's
isn't it funny, right? That it is just the WAF Bake Off thing that's getting you in the door at a lot of customers. I mean, it's great for you, right? But it must be like, okay, sure, that's how we'll be successful. We don't care, exactly. Like, you know.
Yeah, and it's like I always tell Zane, I was like, look, just cover your ears every time I talk about how we're a WAF because I know it makes you cringe.
I think there was because I think really like Signal Sciences was always growing, was always doing well, but I think things really went into hyperdrive like last year when someone did like a few groups did like WAF bake-offs and then like rated you number one. And I'm like, why are you comparing Signal Sciences to like F5? That doesn't make any sense. But hey, it's been a winner for you.
Yeah. And so we've just tried to lean into that message because that's where the most pain is right now for the most.
Exactly. Right.
Right.
Path to market, man. Like whatever works. Andrew Peterson, thank you very much for joining us on the show. Really appreciate your time. And I hope you enjoy the rest of your time at the Gartner Summit there in DC.
Thanks so much, Pat. And thanks for being easy on me on my first time on the show.
That was Andrew Peterson of Signal Sciences there. Big thanks to him for that. And thanks to Signal Sciences for sponsoring this week's Risky Business episode. And that is it for this week's show. I do hope you've enjoyed it. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.